one bad call out.
Good morning and welcome to WMNF's Midpoint, your midweek, mid-morning news and public affairs show, where we examine world and national news through a local perspective. I'm Janet Scherberger, your host today, and we have Frank Knox answering our phones. So if you have any questions or comments, give us a call at 813-239-9663 or send an email to dj@wmnf.org or text us at 813-433-0885. Today, a special Wavemakers edition of Midpoint, where we go deep with someone who's making a difference in the Tampa Bay region. In the studio with me is Paul Guzzo, culture reporter at the Tampa Bay Times. Thanks for being here, Paul.
Thank you for having me.
Paul's stories on abandoned black cemeteries around Tampa Bay prompted a new state law establishing the Abandoned African American Cemeteries Task Force, which aims to identify and record unmarked black burial grounds throughout Florida. In October, the Hillsborough chapter of the NAACP presented Guzzo and cemetery researcher Ray Reed with a President's Award for their work. Paul covers the local film scene, Tampa history, professional wrestling, and the characters who make Tampa unique. He started as a journalist in 1999 at La Gazzetta, and among other things, he covered Cuba issues for the Tampa Tribune. Before becoming a reporter, he was an independent filmmaker, best known for an award-winning documentary on Charlie Wall, Tampa's first crime lord. And he's ghostwritten several books about big Tampa personalities. So basically, Paul doesn't sleep. He's always working. Thank you so much for being here, really, really an honor to have you on the show. And let's talk first about just the cemetery story, which you started working on probably 3 years ago?
2018 or 19. I can't even remember. Everything just kind of bleeds together. Yeah, it's been years. It's been consuming me for 3 or 4 years now.
And we're continuing to break news about it, which we'll talk about that in a minute. But let's start with where did this idea come from and how did you end up writing about this topic?
Wow. Okay. So I wrote a story about some axe murderers from the early 1900s, no, this is true, who, while they were in Hillsborough County Jail, citizens did not think that they were going to get the justice that should be brought to them, so they tried to storm the prison for vigilante justice. And I wrote the story, in the melee, a few people from the mob died. And I get an email from somebody who says, well, they weren't just some people, they had names. And I said, well, how am I supposed to know their names? He said, well, you should look at their death records. And the guy who was emailing me was this guy, Ray Reed, and he sent me their names. And I just asked him, who are you? What is going on? How did you find this so easily? And he explained, well, there's a potter's field in the Hillsborough County. It's still there. And he's like, there's only a few hundred markers there with
and
numbers.
And potter's field is a poor person's grave or something?
Yeah, it's a cemetery for the indigent and the unknown. And this one's called the Cemetery for All People. And Ray was like, there's only a few hundred markers there, but there's thousands of people buried there. So in his retirement, he goes through death records and he's making a list of everyone buried there because he said people deserve to know where their ancestors are buried. So myself and photographer James Borchuk went out and did a story on the efforts he does over that Potter's Field. And when we got to interviewing him, he said, but the real story is Zion. We said, well, what's Zion? He says, I don't know. He said, but I keep finding death records for Zion Cemetery. And everybody buried there is black. But its cemetery doesn't exist anymore. And we're like, so? And he's like, well, that means they're still in the ground somewhere. I thought it sounded too insane, but James, to his credit, said, man, he seemed pretty serious about this. Why don't we look into it? And we started looking into it, and we found, wow, there was a Zion. We found where it was located. We started looking into it, and we found no proof that the bodies were moved, and we just kind of went from there.
So you started with hearing with the death records of people being buried at this place. How did you find Zion? How did you find the cemetery?
So again, I kind of blew the story off for a while and James stayed on me. And I had to go over to the Hillsborough County Library, the downtown one, for a different story. Sometimes when I do these history stories, you have to look through city directories. you know, for like old addresses. So I'm doing that. And while I'm there, I was like, you know what? Let me look up Zion. And I looked like, it's not there. Looked at another year, not there. And, you know, because these city directories are never complete year to year. There's always stuff missing. And then finally, I just randomly opened up one, I think from like 1914 or 1915. And boom, there it was, Zion Cemetery, 3700 North Florida Avenue. Like, oh, whoa. So I immediately go back to the office and I send that address to Rodney Kite Powell over to Tampa Bay History Center. And he goes through the old maps for me. And he immediately sends back, like, look, there was a cemetery there. And it doesn't say Zion Cemetery. It just says Colored People's Cemetery. That's how the cemeteries for African Americans were never given a name on map. They just said the Colored Cemetery. But it was obviously Zion. And so then we sent that over to USF. And their archaeologists there made an overlay to show what would be there now. And that's when we learned, oh, boy, it'd be underneath the Housing Authority property. So then we started looking more and we found out that when the Housing Authority built those in the 50s, they did unearth a few graves, which showed at least some were left behind. So we went through all the, we went through 30, 40 years of death records, pulling every single death certificate we could for Zion. And we then entered those names for Zion Cemetery into all the other county city databases where they might have done a mass relocation of black burials. So it pretty much would have been a city or a county owned cemetery. None of them popped up. We walked Memorial Park Cemetery with our list because that was the black cemetery established in 1919. That's where they could have been moved with our list of hundreds of names. Didn't find them. And so at that point, we were like, well, we couldn't write that they were still there. All we could write is we cannot find where they are. And mm-hmm. that story prompted the Housing Authority to hire the archaeologist who then were able to prove they're all still there.
And then you went from there to, tell me how it went from there to, how many have you unearthed since then?
We've identified 12 possible. Six,
in the Tampa Bay area?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Six have been confirmed through archaeological surveys. And what happened was, this wasn't really like a secret. I mean, I remember hearing when I first moved down here 20-something years ago, well, there used to be a cemetery where MacDill is. It was for black people over in Port Tampa. They didn't move that one. You can find old news archives of reporters doing history stories on Clearwater Heights, which was Clearwater's first black community, and residents there saying, well, they never moved our cemetery, still are under the building, but nobody took these people serious. It sounded like urban legend. Once Zion was found, it kind of emboldened all these people to start coming forward. Like, no, we've been saying for years there's a cemetery here. We've been saying for years there's a cemetery here. And they started reaching out to us and using the same research techniques we used to find Zion, we worked with these people to write more stories to show, look, there could be a cemetery here. And then in six of the cases, property owners have hired archaeologists to look. And we still have, another, I think, another six where they have not looked yet.
Where are these? Can you tell us what the various locations? You said Clearwater,
there's
MacDill.
Two in Clearwater. Then they found some graves underneath the Tropicana parking lot, Tropicana Stadium parking lot. You have one at MacDill Air Force Base. You have the Ridgewood Cemetery, which was on King High School property. Oh boy, there's so many. It really is hard to keep them all straight. There's a possible one on a horse ranch in Odessa, possibly under a shopping plaza in West Tampa. The College Hill Cemetery, which would be in the Italian Club Cemetery's parking lot, which is now the grassy parking lot. Mm-hmm. There was up to 1,200 people buried there at one time. We don't know where they went. So yeah, they've just been everywhere.
And was there a period of time when this was happening? Was it all the early 1900s when they were, what was happening to these properties? There were people who were buried there and someone just came and built a building on them. The properties were sold. How did this come about?
Most of these were established in what would have been the black communities in the late 1800s, early 1900s. So we're talking era of segregation. The white people lived in downtown Tampa, and they didn't want the black residents to live there. So they established their own communities outside of city limits. And each of these communities, of course, needed their own cemetery. As the cities grew, they started growing outwards, and suddenly these black communities were in their way.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted the land. So they would either eminent domain the land, or in some cases, with most of these cemeteries, they taxed them out of existence. So they would annex the land into the city and say, all right, now we're putting in streets and we're putting in plumbing and lighting and you owe us all money for improvement taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't pay the improvement taxes, we're going to take your land and we will revert it back to a previous owner who can pay. most of these cemeteries were full. They were no longer bringing in profit. They were at the, so these cemetery owners, this is just me guessing now, but they must have been like, well, where are we going to come up with $3,000 right. or $1,500 when this is no longer profitable? Thing is, you're not supposed to tax a cemetery, but the cemetery would get taken. It would get reverted back to the original white homesteading family. And then you can see the records that the new white owners would go to the city and say, wait, this is a cemetery. You're not supposed to tax us on this. And the city would say, forgot. Yeah. We're not supposed. And they had forgotten you weren't supposed to tax a cemetery when it was owned by the black residents as soon as a white person owned it. And then the new owner would sell it to a developer, and the developer would pick up the headstones because it's a lot easier and cheaper than moving the bodies and build.
And so I did notice that after your story about the abandoned cemeteries in the Tampa Bay area, I saw stories nationwide about this. And I wonder how much of it is because of your story. And I know we've talked about this before and you're not sure, but did anybody contact you from any of these other places around the country to ask you how you did your research? Because having been a reporter myself, I know a lot of times that's what reporters do. They see a big story in another community, and then they localize it, so to speak. And is it something that happened here locally? So did you hear from anybody around the country and or in other places?
Well, as far as I know, and if I can pat the Tampa Bay Times on the back, we are the only newspaper to find the cemeteries. Other newspapers are reporting on the work that archaeologists were hired to do. So I could be wrong, but as far as I know, we're the only newspaper who's been able to identify cemeteries that then inspired the archaeologists to go look. In these other areas, it is people coming forward and saying, we think there could be a cemetery here, and the city, the county, the property owner immediately hires archaeologists on their own to do the work.
Was that stuff happening before, do you know, before your stuff?
There were cases of it. While we were doing research for Zion, I think we found about 24 examples since the 1990s of people finding cemeteries. But in those cases, they were not discovered through research. They were discovered through construction. So I don't know if previously people identified them before they started digging up the ground.
And when the state legislature passed, was the last legislative session that they created the task force, did you talk to any of the lawmakers about that? How are you involved in that? Were you involved in any way? And just generally, how did it feel to actually
You know, but as a reporter, I had to kind of back away because I didn't want to become the story. So when they would reach out to me, I would just say, no, I can't really talk about this, or I can't come advocate for this. That's not my job. In terms of the bill being passed because of the work, well, yeah, I mean, you know.
Not much better, right, as a reporter?
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest. We all do this because you want to make a difference, but it's also nice to get a nice pat on the back every so often.
Well, and receiving the honor from the NAACP was super cool too. And that was just in October, recently, because your work is continuing. The other thing that I find to be interesting about this story is, and it's something that's so important for journalists, is to listen to people. And I know you were a little bit skeptical at first, but some of the best stories come from listening to people that no one will listen to. That's what some of the work that journalists do. It's some of the value that journalism has, is to actually give a voice to people who are being ignored, like those people who were ignored for decades.
Yeah, and even in terms of Ray Reed, who tipped us off on this, he said he had been trying to get the Times to have any interest in his work for years, and he'd been emailing reporters and calling them, and they always blew him off. And yeah, Ray's eccentric. He's definitely a unique character, and I could see how if somebody gets on the phone with him, they might be like, yeah, I'm not taking this guy seriously. But once you sit down and really listen to him, and you see his research and how much time he puts in everything, you realize he's definitely a unique character, but only a unique character would do the work that he's doing. And that's all it took. Yeah, we listened to him, and it just broke open this Pandora's box.
The other thing that's fascinating is all the work that you said you did with going to the library and looking at city directories and maybe even looking at newspaper stories. And so much of this kind of historical research depends on the first brush of history that is written by your local newspaper. And, you know, what's happening right now with our local news, it's diminishing so much. Does it concern you that this kind of stuff is going to be lost 30 years from now? Somebody may, or 50 years ago from now, 100 years from now, will somebody be able to go back and know what Tampa was like before it was underwater? That was a joke.
I would say the concern would be this. Only print journalism would be willing to allow a reporter to spend the hours, days, months, and I think we worked on it, Zion, for 9 months, to chase a story that might not even be a story. Like, we didn't know that. For all we knew, I was going to do 9 months of research, and then somebody was going to send me a selfie of them with all the graves from Zion moved into another cemetery. Only print journalism will put the resources into something like that. And that's no disrespect to television or radio. They have different kind of work that they do. But print will allow a reporter to go down that rabbit hole for 9 months. And that's the danger of losing print journalism.
But now that, and just so many different things, like losing the directories. We don't have directories anymore, right? There's so much work, that research that's done on looking at phone directories and looking at old newspapers and things like that.
And the old land deeds. So I wasn't the first person to look for Zion. Leland Halls, the great Tampa Tribune. Yeah. He tried to find it in the 80s. He also tried to find College Hill Cemetery in the 80s because he had heard rumors of these black cemeteries being destroyed. The difference between our work was, in the 80s when he went looking, all these archives weren't digitized. So it wasn't a needle in a haystack for him. It was a needle in a billion haystacks, mm-hmm. wherein newspaper articles have all been digitized. It's just easier to find land deeds now than it was when mm-hmm. he was doing it. Death records weren't digitized in the 80s. The digitization of archives has allowed us to not just retell history, but to rediscover history. And I mean, if Leland had at his disposal what I have today, we would have found these in the 80s.
It's funny you bring up Leland Hawes, because for our listeners who don't know who he is, Leland Hawes was a legendary reporter at the Tampa Tribune, who was a historian, was really our local historian. He wrote history stories. And I was just telling somebody yesterday that I feel like, Paul, you are sort of our new Leland Hawes, because you are a historian reporter. I think you're probably a little more edgy than Leland, but the same love of history and digging that up and being really our historian reporter. And that's what you're doing now. I'm wondering where that love of history came from for you.
Well, first of all, I would never compare myself to Leland, but I was honored that in the final months before he passed away, I actually got to start spending time with him. I'd go over to his house over in South Tampa off West Shore, and we'd have coffee, and he would tell me old stories. I always loved, he would never call somebody a gangster or a corrupt politician. He would always say, well, they're the type of guy who would like to smoke cigars in back rooms. In terms of history, I mean, I've always loved history. I grew up in Ewing, New Jersey, which is a suburb of Trenton. And my house was a 5-minute bike ride from where George Washington crossed the Delaware. So we had all those colonial museums everywhere. So you grew up in that area, you grew up around history. But when I got into journalism, you need to find a niche, something to make yourself unique. Stand out. I couldn't get a job with the daily newspapers. They had no interest in me. So I had to find some way to be a voice outside of the daily newspapers. And nobody was covering history and like this. So I just started diving in and, doing this. And I found that there's this love and nostalgia, this love of trying to solve cold case mysteries of history. And just developed from there.
We've got a call. Let's take this call from, we've got Tom in Tampa is on the line. Tom in Tampa, you're on the line. What's on your mind?
Hey, Paul, this is Tom. You remember me from the clerk's office, I hope.
Full disclosure, my husband, Tom Scherberger. Thanks for calling, Tom.
I don't think a lot of people appreciate how much time it took you going through all of the records at the clerk's office. And I remember a moment when you had asked for the plat map of the cemetery, and I pulled it out in my office, and you and James were, doing high fives. And it ended up on the front page of the newspaper. But I think the amount of time you put into it, and can you explain to people why it took that much time? People probably just think, just go online and look this stuff up. Why is it so hard?
When people ask me about these cemeteries, I always like to say it's not finding the bodies and bringing some respect to the cemetery is the primary thing that we're proud of. But secondary has been, we haven't just written like, oh, there could be bodies there. We've developed a full history of these cemeteries and the people who live there and who built it. And just, we've told the history. And yeah, you just can't Google who originally owned Zion Cemetery. Land deeds, it is. It's like finding a needle in a haystack. You need to find out where in the area it could have been and possible names of owners. And did they have corporations they could have bought it under? And, you know, you'd have to look, you know, I think we looked under 100 possible people who may have owned Zion before we finally found that Richard Dobie of Dobieville owned it. And it's just, yeah, you look.
I was just impressed with the amount of documentation. You were not satisfied with getting a few deeds or the possibility. Yeah, it looks like there was, but you know, you really wanted to get that map, which showed exactly where the cemetery was with the name on it and dates and things like that. And that just seemed like was such an important link in your trail.
Oh, yeah. Once we found the plat maps, that was it. We knew, okay, there was a cemetery there. But yeah, you're right. It was and still is an obsession, if not just finding where these are, but everything about them. You know, we went with every single death record that we found. We didn't just pull the death record. We then went through news archives and entered every single person who was buried there, their names in the news archives to find bios on them, histories. Who were these people? Because that's all part of the story. If you know, you can't be lazy. You can't half you know what it. You have to go all in.
Yep.
And meanwhile, you had other stories to write. So that's another.
Yeah, I was still grinding out 3-4 stories a week.
Go take 6 months. All you have to do is this one story. You were doing all sorts of other things. So anyway, props to you, Paul. I'll let you guys get back to you.
And thanks for all your help while we were doing this.
Thanks for the call, Tom. I'm going to read a couple. If you're just tuning in, this is WMNF Tampa. You're listening to Midpoint. We've got a special Wave Makers edition, and we're talking to Tampa Bay Times culture reporter Paul Guzzo. If you'd like to give us a call, go ahead and call 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org. We've got a couple of emails I want to read. David Bryant is asking, is Paul aware of the Angola community located south of Tampa Bay? Is that something that's familiar to you? New College of Florida has done a good job documenting the community. Not familiar. Is that?
I've not looked into that, no, but I will.
Maybe something to look into next. We've got somebody, I'm going to read this comment from Bubba. I worry about the death of newspapers and the rise of fake news sources like Newsmax and Breitbart. Americans need to wake up. I would think Paul probably agrees with that. Somebody else is asking, so in Tampa, this is, I don't have a name, but this is a text message. Somebody is saying, after finding all these lost body parts, he's calling them in quotes, lost body parks in Tampa, what is your next amazing adventure? He says, in Tampa, we steal burial lots. I bet we have other places stolen, not just forgotten. And it leads me to another question is, did this happen to white cemeteries or this was only black cemeteries? Is this a phenomenon that happens that sometimes we build over cemeteries?
So it happened to white cemeteries, not in the Tampa Bay area. But I'm sure it's happened. The College Hill Cemetery, it was for blacks and Cubans. So there were, you know, white people buried there. But so when developers were erasing these cemeteries, they didn't look on a map and say, let's go destroy a black cemetery because we're racist. Any historian I've talked to said they would have done that to a white cemetery, too. It just made more sense in their mind to just get rid of the headstones and build because it was too costly to move a cemetery. The difference with the white cemeteries was in the early 1900s, they had voices. They had political backing. They had power behind them to say, no, you're not going to destroy our cemetery. You can find next to Zion was the Catholic cemetery. When they moved that, you can find the old articles. They moved that the same time that Zion was erased. Mm. It's front page stories. Meetings with City Hall. I mean, this was the people, the families would then watch as they moved the bodies at the cemetery to make sure it was done right. But the black residents had no voice. You're talking about a city where black people weren't even voting in city elections back then because it was white-only primaries. It just, they didn't have any power. They didn't have a voice. And when developers saw that they could get no pushback on just erasing the cemetery, that was that made more financial sense. But they would have done it to white cemeteries. They just couldn't.
And really, to me, that gets to the nut of why this story matters, is that, you know, I'm not a cemetery person. I don't have any relatives that are buried. I don't even know where my relatives are buried. I think about them, but I don't go to cemeteries. And I think there are some people who are like that, that don't, they're not cemetery people. They wonder why does it matter? And I think what you just said really gets to the point of it. Why does it matter? Because some people do care about that, and it was about disrespect is really what it was about, and not giving a voice to a community.
Yeah, and you could see how much these cemeteries mattered to the communities, because like when they once they found the graves with ground penetrating radar, or they still have to confirm physically that the radar is finding are correct. So they will dig a few graves to make sure, yes, there is a coffin there, and they'll find personal belongings there. It was a tradition, especially among some of the Caribbean communities that were here, to bury somebody with a conch shell, or because I think it symbolizes something with the passing to the next life, or burying them with the last thing that they held before they died. And those items were in the graves with them. As you can see, this wasn't just, hey, somebody died and now we need to put them in a grave. Like these spots, they meant something to the families. And then I can't help but you feel sorry for the people who were there, you know, who were in the ground, but they were dead already. I can't imagine the families, the helplessness they must have felt.
Right.
How powerless they must have felt, how insignificant, when all they could do was sit there and watch as a developer built a store over their mother's grave. And that must have just been, when we reached out to families and said, hey, we found through doing an ancestor, we found that you have an ancestor buried in Zion. And they'd say, who's who? And I would show them the paperwork and they'd be like, well, that was my grandfather's brother. And he never mentioned he had a brother. That's bizarre. And it just seems like it became so painful that rather than talking about Zion, they just pretended it was never there and that those family members were never there because it was too painful to talk about.
And that cemetery is actually going to get a marker now, or a historical marker. Is that something that's in the works?
So they formed a nonprofit, some of the stakeholders, and the housing authority, when they demolish their buildings on top of that, I believe it's four, they're not going to rebuild anything on that. They're going to turn that into a memorial park.
Great.
Two other property owners own the rest of what was Zion Cemetery. The Tola, and then Richard Gonsmar owned a portion. And the nonprofit is hoping to reassemble all the parcels and turn that into a 2.5-acre memorial site.
Wow.
It would be a park. We would benches, you can go there and reflect and have a fountain. And then, yeah, there'll be a marker, talk about Zion. And they also want to build like kind of like an ancestry center where you can go to like this facility and learn how to do, learn how to look into your ancestry.
What's the time? Is there a timetable on that?
Not yet. And I think they still have to raise quite a bit of money to do it.
How do people, do you know how people get in touch with them? Or what the name of the nonprofit is? Or
I think you can go to the Housing Authority's website and it'll all be there.
Oh, okay, great. Let's talk a little bit though about how you ended up here and doing this. So you grew up in New Jersey and you got a degree in journalism. So did you always want to be a reporter? Was that your big dream? You wanted to be a Woodward and Bernstein?
No, I was I was a political science major in college. I don't know what I wanted to do with that. It just with a degree, you know. My father was a lobbyist, so it seemed to make sense for me to go into political science. But there was a political science stats class, and they only offered it like every 3 or 4 quarters. And the quarter that I took it, I started dating a woman who was a bartender on that same night. And I was underage, but she can get me into the bar. So I kept skipping that class to the point where I had to drop it. And my counselor was like, well, you're supposed to graduate in a year and a half, and this class isn't going to be offered again. What are you going to do? I said, well, I'll switch majors. And I had a friend who always made dean's list, always went out. And I was like, well, how do you do that? He said, well, I'm a journalism major. I said, so? He said, well, we don't have tests. Excuse me, I'm recovering from a head cold. So I switched to journalism for that reason. I figured I could graduate in a year and a half.
This was an easy degree.
It was an easy degree. I didn't know I would like it, but after the first quarter, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the research. I enjoyed writing. And I was like, oh, I'm actually kind of good at this. And so I just went from there.
And then you came to Tampa. How'd you end up in Tampa?
So when I was in college, my roommate and his girlfriend were supposed to go down to Bradenton to visit one of his girlfriend's friends. My roommate got called into work. and for the weekend, and he couldn't go. And she's like, well, what am I supposed to do? Who am I going to go to Florida with? She was driving. I said, I got $100 in my pocket. So I went. And while in Bradenton, we visited Tampa for a day, and I loved it. And I knew I didn't want to stay in New Jersey after I graduated college. And so I decided I'm going to graduate. I'll stick around for 1 year in New Jersey, save some money, and then I'm just going to move to Tampa. I came down here on a 3-month lease with all of my life savings and a cigar box. And yeah, it just, I stayed.
But you, when you were first here, was that your first job? Was you went right to La Gazzetta when you moved here?
No, when I first got down here, I was just doing anything to pay the bills, you know, telemarketing, manual labor, whatever I could do. And about 2 or 3 months after moving here, my brother had moved down at that point, and we're up late, we're playing Paperboy on Nintendo. And I said, you know what, I can't sleep, let me go get a newspaper at the newspaper box, see if I can find a real job. And La Gazzetta was hiring, and I didn't sleep all night. Because I was just, you know, writing my resume and getting everything ready. And I called and set up an interview. And I remember going in, and Pat Mantega, who's still the publisher and editor, I did an interview. And he just looked at me. He's like, you know what? I don't feel like interviewing anybody else. You got the job. And if you screw up, at least you get a paycheck for a few weeks. And I was there for about 10 years.
Wow. What were you covering there?
Like I said, you cover everything. You do everything from writing profiles to helping cover the Lightning to delivering the newspapers. I mean, to doing the layout. Everything there is to do with the newspaper, if you work at La Gazzetta, you're doing.
But around that time, you also made a film, a documentary film that won an award. Was it at the Gasparilla Film Festival that won award, or was it?
It won one at Gasparilla. It won awards at quite a few places. The documentary on Charlie Wall, who was Tampa's first, you know, organized crime leader.
And that was, a lot of that was set in Ybor City, right?
Yeah, so, you know, how that happened was Ace Atkins wrote White Shadow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a former Tribune reporter, wrote The White Shadow, which is a fictional account of Charlie Wall's murder mixed with some Cuba stuff going on, you know, the crime novel. And I profiled him for La Gazzetta. And my brother and I were both also independent filmmakers. And just in conversation after interviewing him, I mentioned it. He said, you know what you need to do? You need to interview some of my sources for White Shadow. These are the people who investigated the Charlie Wall murder, and they're older, and they're not going to be here forever, and it'd be great to have their interviews on tape. Well, sure. So my brother and I went and interviewed a few of them and realized, oh, this is fascinating. This is a documentary. And it went from there. And yeah, we won Best Florida Film at the Gasparilla Film Fest. We won quite a few awards around the country for it.
And then how did you go from the La Gazzetta to the Tribune?
So at that point, I left La Gazzetta after 10 years just to freelance. I'd done everything I could do at La Gazzetta. So I started doing, I had enough freelance clients that I could become my own boss.
Newspaper, or were you writing
magazines,
news stories, magazines?
Magazine, okay. People hiring me to do research, ghostwriting books. But I still wanted to work for daily newspaper. But for 12 years, they didn't just not give me jobs. I didn't even get like a rejection letter. I didn't even get like, hey, thanks for applying. Well, look, you know, both newspapers kept pretending I didn't exist. My wife owned a coffee shop on Harbor Island at the time, and the new owners of the Tribune would go in there for coffee. And every time they would go in, my wife would say, serve them the coffee. And she'd be like, but when are you going to hire my husband? And she did that for weeks. And so finally one day, one of the guys was like, fine. No, that's not how it works. So one of the days, one of the owners was in there and he's reading a magazine and he said, how did this Tampa magazine get an interview with The Rock and we can't? And my wife said, well, that's my husband. And he's like, oh, and he starts reading the story and he realizes every publication in the coffee house it's there because it's something that I wrote for.
Huh.
And he starts reading through everything and he called me from the coffee shop and says, you know, meet me in my office. Let me interview you. And he hired me for a column. And 2 months later, they brought me on full time.
What was the column?
Doing a history column every 2 weeks. Just
the Leland Hawes.
Yeah.
The Leland Hawes. And then, but you also had a niche as covering Cuba issues.
Yeah. So when I got hired by the Tribune, he hired me without really a beat. He just said, yeah, you're hired. People seem to like you. But I didn't have a beat. So I kind of had to develop my own. So I said, well, nobody's covering history. So I did that. Nobody was covering film or TV. So I took that on. And then as U.S.-Cuba relations started amping up, I realized nobody was covering that. So I just kind of educated myself, trying to create my own beat. So I didn't just have to write obits all day. And then I when I started doing that, I had no idea that a year and a half later, Obama would normalize relations and suddenly it would become like a full-time beat. And it did. And it was, That was my favorite time writing.
Well, there was a time when probably the Tribune and the Times actually had reporters based in Cuba.
Yeah.
Or in Latin America, covering Latin America. So you were doing it from Tampa and became an expert on that. And then, of course, the Tribune was purchased by the Times. Not a lot of reporters made the switch from the Tribune to the Times, but you were among them.
Yeah, and it was because of that Cuban niche. I mean, I don't know that for certain, but I have to assume it because the reporters that they brought over immediately were those who had a niche that they did not have somebody on full-time at the Times.
I want to go, we got some calls and emails that I want to read, so I want to get to that. I do want to mention quickly, though, before I do that, about you talked about ghostwriting books, all the different books that you have written. It's just some of you know, the most prominent people in the Tampa Bay community. So you're working with Dick Greco on a book. I know that's in the works, not moved. Titus O'Neill, you've written a book for him. Dick Corbett, who was the developer of International Plaza and a big benefactor to he and his wife to Tampa Museum of Art. Bob Clark, Sr. of Tampa Steel. Del Stewart. And you've got other the history of Tampa's India American population. And then also you're working on a memoir detailing a Tampa family's role in Castro's rise to power. That sounds fascinating.
That book... Yeah, Raul Villamia, he passed away a little over a year ago. Luckily, working with his daughter, we got the book done. It's the most fascinating thing I've ever written. Sadly, it's hard to get a memoir with a big publisher now unless it's about a reality star or somebody doing a tell-all about the president. But we're looking for a publisher. I hope to find one. It's firsthand accounts with the Castros, firsthand accounts of gun smuggling, organized crime meetings. It's a fascinating look at Tampa's Cuban population and just the outsized and unknown role that they played in helping Fidel Castro, who, to be clear, Tampa almost unanimously was supporting Fidel Castro during the revolution. Nobody at the time knew he was going to become communist, socialist. They just wanted Batista, who was just as vicious a dictator as there's ever been, out of power. And so, Tampa rallied to help Castro. And then, of course, after he won, he embraced the USSR and communism. And at that point, Tampa kind of backed away.
Right. Okay, so let's take, we've got an email from Beatrice who asks, was there ever an official statement by Hillsborough County or the city of Tampa that officially ended segregation of cemeteries? And she notes that some places like Woodlawn Cemetery, there's a very small area set aside for African-American burials. There are only 6 or 7 gravestones there today. And then let's see, there was apparently in 71 when, she says, when the city deeded Woodlawn Cemetery land to Showman's Rest for a cemetery back in 1971, there were written covenants set by the city prohibiting African-American burials there. So she wants to know what you know about that. And then also, do you happen to know where Afro-Cubans were buried historically?
Okay, so Afro-Cubans would have been in the other black cemeteries. Quite a few of them were buried in College Hill Cemetery because that was a cemetery for Cubans and blacks, and a lot of the Afro-Cubans did live in the Ybor area. Zion Cemetery, you could find when we would do the ancestry, the people buried there, that, yeah, their families came from the Caribbean countries. As for when we stopped segregating cemeteries, I don't know. That's a good question that I don't know the answer to, but I'd like to know.
I'll bet you'll find out.
Yeah, I don't know if there's any. I mean, I don't know if there's ever a written proclamation.
Yeah.
I guess it
just ended with desegregation. I don't know. Yeah, interesting. But she was saying there was a covenant on the purchase, so they would have had to have changed that at some point. Here's another one from Pat. Patricia in Seminole, who wants to know if you have found information on indigenous cemeteries which might have been built over, such as the, and I probably won't pronounce this right, Tocobaga communities in Safety Harbor. I live in the city of Seminole with Osceola High School nearby. Seminole tribes intermixed with black slave escapees. Do you have info on locations where indigenous or mixed Afro-Florida indigenous burial grounds might similarly have been desecrated? Is this fodder for future research for you?
Well, they did find... anytime they're building in downtown, they always have to build with the thought process that we first need to check to see that we're not going to tearing down a building that's on top of a cemetery.
But that was probably relatively recent that we've done that. Is that?
Well, yeah. They found while building Fort Brook Garage, they did find some Seminole Native American graves when building.
Water Street or something down there where they were building. They found some stuff.
Some while building the forum. They found some.
Yep.
There's the burial mound over in Felipe Park. There's some in St. Pete. So yeah, but we find them. Unfortunately, they wouldn't be on maps.
Right. They're not going to be recorded the way the black cemeteries are. The other thing that they've done certain desecration, that there was a time when they would actually, from the shell mounds, like use the shells from the shell mounds for new construction.
Yeah.
So not only were they erasing them, they were literally taking them apart and using them for other things.
I'm guessing on this, but I believe it wasn't until the 70s that we had state laws protecting cemeteries. So you have to remember, when developers were erasing these cemeteries, they weren't breaking the law.
Right.
There was nothing. It was completely legal what they were doing. Immoral, yeah, but it was legal. They weren't doing anything illegal.
Yeah. We've got, let's see. I'm going to take this call from, they're saying their name is Twinkle in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Let's see. Twinkle.
Yeah,
you're on the line. What's on your mind?
Hi, I wanted to say something about heritage when I first called, but just listening to your story, you need to do your own documentary. You're amazing. I love the visual of the stories and the coffee shop and everything. And I just wanted to thank you, because to me, heritage is a big deal. And I know that if you have access to that, the way that you brought this in journalism is amazing. And I now want to get a subscription, because I too, like one of the earlier callers or writers, I also am grieving the loss of print news. And I definitely am I'm so impressed and very grateful that we have somebody like you doing that kind of digging. It's the old way. And when I'm of the generation that's watched, we went from black and white TV to now everything, you know, so I've watched these transformations. And there are some things, I do love technology and I love modernism and everything like that, but I also really do grieve that kind of journalism, digging in, getting the story, the actual story, not colored with emotion. But you are obviously very compassionate as well. And it's just been wonderful to listen to you talk. And I am completely floored that we are so lucky to have WMNF in this community, and that right here in Tampa, we have all this access. And I'm in Bowling Green. I grew up in Sarasota. I was born there. And so the caller that said, or the writer about that community south of Tampa, mm-hmm. I lived in that neighborhood. It's right on the river in Bradenton. And it was, what we heard was, it was the first stronghold of slaves coming down and mm-hmm. Indians and people like that. So it's got a lot of archaeological value there. So it is something to look into. It's really fascinating. The whole area, I mean, it's just amazing, but I wanted to thank you. I missed your name in the beginning.
Paul Guzzo, G-U-Z-Z-O, Paul Guzzo.
You are amazing, and I want to see a movie about you. I love the way you speak. I love your stories. I think your take on everything and your humanity is just, it's a gift, man.
Well, I can say this, a movie showing me at the county clerk's office looking at deeds for 9 months would be really, really boring.
That would just be part of the montage. quick montage.
The college course. I'm a musician, so I have many, many great guitar player friends who say they got into it for the girls, you know, but they
funny.
Became great. You just never know why you get into something, but you're in the right job for you.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Love having a listener from Bowling Green, Kentucky. That's often awesome. You can stream us online. Clay in Land O'Lakes, you're on the air. What's on your mind, Clay? Thanks for calling.
First, thanks for taking my call. And second, happy holidays to everyone and a better new year. I think we should get rid of this happy new year stuff and wish everyone a better new year. The happy stuff isn't working for us. So, there's a couple of things. I specifically want to talk about the cemetery issue, but something that your guest talked about was that the embrace of communism by Fidel Castro, and that's why, you know, what those camp supporters and all that stuff. That's not true. The reality is that Castro came to this country to talk to President Kennedy and tell him how much he wanted to bring democracy to Cuba. But because of special interests and all that, it didn't happen. And communism only got embraced because the big bad USA was doing everything it could to get rid of Cuba and its leadership, Fidel Castro, and they need an ally, and the only ally there is that's strong enough to look up to the United States was Russia.
Mm-hmm.
That's how that happened. So, so the point is about, first off, I want to congratulate your guest on his hard work and all the wonderful things he's done. He's fantastic at illuminating the true history of the area. And I say that knowing that here in Pasco County, where I live, Land O'Lakes, we found a cemetery called Mount Carmel on Aaron's Cutoff that was slated for development. And when we found it, we and a number of others approached the county commission who extracted the whole area, and we've been out there and we've cleaned up the cemetery. It's an ongoing thing.
I'm well familiar with it. I've been out there a few times.
Oh, good. So I'm one of those wackos who went out there and cleaned out all the brush and everything, and you know, prepared the place. So it's wonderful that what you're doing. I got to tell you, I don't understand how this happened. That we just ignore that there are places where, we place people that should be sacred and not violated, and we let it happen all the time.
You know, you bring up a good point. Yvette Lewis of the Hillsborough County NAACP said it a few months back when she says, we should all be a little embarrassed that the only black cemetery in Hillsborough County had been Memorial Park, and that wasn't established till 1919. And she's like, so nobody ever thought to wonder, wait, where were black people buried before 1919? And there's no way they could all fit on that one piece of land. And it's amazing that all those decades and nobody ever asked that. And I didn't even ask that question when I started doing this, but it seemed like the most obvious question to ask, where were people being buried before that?
Yep.
You know what I think is amazing is the fact that you have taken this as you have, and continued, and will continue, I assume, to pursue it to the point that we try to rectify the ills of our ways in the past.
Yeah, Clay, I agree, Clay. It wasn't just a one-time story. Thanks for calling in, Clay. We're running out of time.
Stay healthy, and thank you for your time.
Thanks,
Clay. We're running out of time, so I want to make sure that we talk a little bit more about some of Paul's other beats, specifically the film scene, because I feel like we're in a really interesting time right now with the Tampa Bay area. With right now, we've got Selling Tampa Bay, which is I think for a while was the top show on Netflix. You just recently reported that there's a couple other films that are being, TV shows that are being filmed here. What else is happening with the Tampa film scene? And, you know, speaking of history, you probably know this too, that there was, I think, around Sun City or around South, they tried to make that into a Hollywood. That at one point was going to be like the Hollywood of the East. And then they even around Whedon Island at some point were talking about making that into like an area for film studios. So we don't have film studios here, but we do have a lot of movies and TV shows being filmed here.
Well, yeah, forever, it seems, people have been saying that the Tampa Bay area will become the Hollywood of the South. But it's just never happened, primarily because in order to become the Hollywood of the South, you have to be willing to invest in it. And so Atlanta has become the Hollywood of the South. They put billions of dollars into a studio there that attracted all the Marvel movies. I'm not saying if that's the right or wrong approach. That's just the approach. That's just what it took. When the state wasn't willing to invest in the Florida film industry, both counties, Pinellas and Hillsborough, they passed their own smaller film incentive packages where you can do up to 10% on what is spent in their county. Pinellas, I think, puts about $1 million in a pot a year. Hillsborough County, about $500,000. And that's not going to draw a Marvel movie here.
No.
But what it's done is it's these made-for-television movies, these Hallmark movies, Lifetime movies, typically shoot with budgets in the high six figures or in the seven figures. And so that 10% back is enough to bring them here. So we're becoming this made-for-television movie market with Hallmark and Lifetime shooting just about regularly here. And, you know, it's not as splashy as Marvel or Star Wars, but it puts the Tampa Bay area on the screen. It promotes the area. And more importantly, it's providing jobs to the people who work in the film industry.
Well, interesting, the selling Tampa really is like a... That is like a marketing piece practically for, to a certain extent. I mean, if that's something that appeals to you, but it certainly that makes the city look just beautiful. And it's an odd kind of thing because they call it Selling Tampa. I don't know if you've watched it or not, Paul, but but they show so much of Pinellas beaches, one huge community. But it's really interesting. What are the other two shows that are
getting ready to film? Tampa is going to be on Undercover Boss and Dirty Jobs, both in the first week of January and those season premieres. I think we're becoming a market for reality television because we're a growing city and so much of us looks new. And every other city, major city, has just been filmed to death. And we're something different and we're this pretty area you can film and just right place, right time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Tampa in general, and you've been here long enough to know that I feel like right now this our community really is just kind of on fire. I think between just what's happening just in the general consciousness of the world or the country, and not just because of what's happening on Netflix, but also having Tom Brady here, you know? I mean, I know people all over the country are watching Bucks games now because it's Tom Brady, right?
Yeah.
Even people from New England.
I can't believe how big the city's gotten. When I lived in Hyde Park 20 years ago, there's only two bars to go to. So let that sink in for everybody. There were two bars in Hyde Park just 20 years ago when I lived there.
What were those two?
The Chatterbox.
Oh.
And, oh boy, what's the other one? It's still there where Tiny Tap.
Oh, Tiny Tap. So yeah, that is still there.
That was the night out on Howard Avenue.
What do you see as the future for films? And do you think it's going to go beyond this? And just back, Dirty Jobs. What job is it that they're doing?
They're filming a company. He's going to work on building bridges in Pinellas County.
Oh, okay. So construction. So that's perfect. That hits a lot of levers. What about Undercover Boss? What's that one?
College Hunks Hauling Junk.
Ah, yes, okay.
The two founders said they wanted to remember what it was like to get out there on the trucks.
I know, I heard that the show that does the bar makeovers wanted to do one at the Hub.
Oh, that would be great.
I know, the Hub said no. But
why does the Hub need more business?
Well, it doesn't need a makeover. I think some people feel like it's fine just the way it is. I just think it's funny that they even, I mean, the best makeover that they had there is that they made people quit smoking in there. So that's really all the makeover that they need. So what's next for you? Are you in terms, what are you working on? Is there anything else that we should be looking for from you? And
well, I am still looking for one last cemetery. Every time I say one last, my editors laugh because I've said that before, but I really do think this is the last. I don't want to give out the name because I don't want to spoil it yet, but this is the hardest one yet. Found 400-something death records, but unlike the other ones, there's no indication of it on a map. Can't find it in city directories. It is not just a lost cemetery. It's a ghost cemetery. I'm going to keep looking. You know, maybe I'll find it next week. Maybe it'll be 2 years, but I'm going to keep looking.
And those are African-American?
Yes.
And those you got from looking at the death records?
This is Ray Reed, the same guy who came up with the one for Zion, said, here's a few more. He didn't say a few more. He's like, here's 400 for a cemetery that we don't know where it's at. And so I work with Ray, on that research. And the History Center, USF, it's always a collaboration. I don't do this myself. I have a lot of people who help me out.
And if you, I take it you're interested in hearing from the community. If anybody has any tips for you or ideas or somebody who wants to talk to you a little bit more about the Angola community, how do people reach you?
Email pguzzo, that's P-G-U-Z-Z-O @tampabay.com. No R, just pguzzo@tampabay.com.
And Paul, thanks so much for being on the show. Really, really appreciate it. It's really fascinating and enjoy watching your work. And I know that our listeners and callers or emails and calls show that there are a lot of people who are actually really supportive of everything that you do. And thanks for being part of the Tampa Bay community. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Stay tuned for NPR News up next, followed by Duncan Strauss with Talking Animals, and then the amazing afternoon music show with Scott Elliott. This is WMNF Tampa.